Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who and what made Charles Darwin the scientist that he was? Born February 12, 1809, Darwin was the son of a physically frail but highly intelligent mother and a demanding father who worked as a doctor but blanched at the sight of blood. He grew up loving science and despising school, and might very well have spent his career as a rural parson had his family's wealth not allowed him to devote his mind to the study of the natural world without the need for a paycheck to support his wife and the 10 children she bore him. Keith Thompson is Professor Emeritus of Natural History at the University of Oxford. He writes about the fascinating contrasts in Darwin's personal life in his new book, The Young Charles Darwin. Keith, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
It's so interesting to learn that Darwin's teachers would hardly have pegged him as the student most likely to succeed.
I think he slightly liked to encourage that view. They might have had a slightly better impression of him than the view that we get from reading his autobiography. I think the one thing that's clear about him, though, is he hated being lectured to. And so whenever he was in a situation like at school or at the University of Edinburgh when he was in medical school, where the instruction was in form of lectures, he seems to have tuned right out and done very badly.
He did, like always, collecting things from nature. What did he do with the things that he would pick up?
Well, it started at a very early age. He collected plants. He collected insects, particularly his whole life collected insects. And the great fascination of collecting insects is, I suppose, twofold. One is to classify them so that you find out what they are, to identify them, and then you arrange them in groups like with like and so on. And he assembled quite a large, what you would call a cabinet, of drawers and drawers of preserved specimens. And when he was an undergraduate at Cambridge, he shared this with his cousin, William Darwin Fox, who was also at Cambridge, and they worked at it together. And they probably created one of the best private collections of insects, particularly for young people, in the country at the time. So he wasn't just an amateur at this. He was really very, very good at it.
And it put him in a great position, I guess, to notice patterns among different kinds of creatures and adaptations that would later serve him very well.
That's right. That's right. This was essentially a hobby, but you might almost say it was a passion. It was very sort of trendy, popular thing to do in the 1820s, of collecting particularly beetles, gave him a sort of a grounding and a foundation for the whole of his later life, which you could never have gotten from just reading books.
He was close to his brother, even though they were 5 years apart, and they had, I guess, similar interests when it came to science.
Yes, the whole of Darwin's life, he seems to have been dependent very much on a series of mentors and people who guided him, helped him, smoothed the path for him. It may have a lot to do with his mother having died when he was only eight, and he was brought up by his older sisters. And particularly, he grew up following around his older brother, Erasmus. When he went off to Edinburgh, it was Erasmus who went with him. When he moved to the University of Cambridge, Erasmus was there, and so on. And this continued, and then later, of course, in life, he had his wonderful wife, Emma, who provided this tremendous supporting sort of cocoon of family for him. But he seemed very much dependent on other people, and throughout his whole life, Erasmus, who was, he trained as a doctor, but never became a doctor, I think was his closest companion intellectually.
You mentioned Darwin's mother. He wrote that he hardly remembered her, even though he was 8 years old when she died. Were you able to get a sense of the kind of influence that she might have had on him?
Yes, I think it's twofold. One is that it's quite odd in a way that he could remember so little, or he said in his autobiography that he could remember so little about his mother, and particularly of her illness, although he remembered seeing her on her deathbed and so on. While his sisters, even his younger sister, Catherine, remembers so much more about her, there's a lot of professional and amateur psychologists who have delved into this, and naturally enough, they think that he may have been repressing a great deal this sense of loss and betrayal of the disappearance of his mother at such an early age. But the other things that he has written and which other people had written in letters about the time, which show that she was a remarkably interesting woman, a keen gardener, very interested in natural history, a very serious reader, and she had apparently been quite interested in Linnaeus's system of classification of plants, which as when Darwin was only 7 or 8, she was trying to explain to him. So this is a very interesting family of sort of overachieving people. But there's this dreadful gap in his life. When she disappears from his life, it seems that memory of her disappeared too. And at that point, he became very introspective, very much a loner, shy. He had a bad stammer when he was youngest. And he would go for long walks by himself, which was something you might do if you were 16 or 18, but not when you were 9 or 10.
What was the sense, Keith, that you got about how his mother's long illness, I guess she was frail throughout most of his childhood, might have had on the way he perceived his own health?
I think very much. I think it's part of what I was just saying. The death of his mother and the illness of mother produced in him this terrible fear of illness and fear of death. And it is very easy to imagine a sensitive child every time he got a tummy ache or a headache thinking, oh, I'm going to die like mummy did and so on. And this sort of terrible systemic anxiety seems to have followed him all the way through his life. And he was obsessed with his own health, and he was obsessed with the health of his children. He married, as you know, his first cousin, Emma Wedgwood. His mother was Susanna Wedgwood. And he was very worried about inbreeding and the fact that his children, several of whom were quite frail and died early, had inherited sort of congenital weakness, health weakness. So health was just something that he obsessed on from a very early age, and most people think it has a lot to do with the death of his mother.
His wife, Emma, does seem to have been an exceptionally patient person. and the Darwin you describe is not a bad guy, but really into his own thoughts and his own needs and his own head.
Yes, I think I use the term self-obsessed, and I've been criticized for that. People say, well, don't you just mean focused? And I say, no, he was focused, but he was focused on himself. And Emma she was 30 when he proposed to her. She had, I'm sure, essentially, this is very much like Jane Austen, you know, but she had, of the sisters, she had given up the thought that she would become married. And he was just about 30, and many people have probably given up the thought that he might get married. She was very, very religious, and this was a constant sort of underlying difficulty between the two as his theories got him away from being religious. She was did not make that journey with him. But she seems to have been the most wonderfully patient, perfect mother, like so many people of this right at the beginning of the Victorian period. She was essentially pregnant continuously. She had 10 children, and as soon as one was finished nursing, then she would be pregnant again. And it went on, and it was the same with Darwin's own mother and so on. But she created this cocoon for him at their house in the country in Kent, where she managed the servants, which she managed everything so that nothing interfered with his all-important work. And every moment of the day focused and revolved around Charles Darwin.
And in fact, his day really incorporated her a lot, too. We always imagine him being off in a lab somewhere. But as you write, he worked usually for 90 minutes at a stretch very intently and then hung out with her for a while and then went back to it.
Yes, it's almost not an idyllic arrangement if you think about it. Instead of going to the office from 9 to 5, having to commute and all those things, he got up early, worked, had breakfast, read the newspapers, and then he would walk, and then maybe they would read the correspondence together, and she would read novels to him. After lunch, he would lie down, and she would read to him or play the piano, and then he would work for another few hours, and so on. But all arranged around him. I don't think ever anybody had a thought to, well, how would Emma like to arrange the day?
How closely did she follow his work? I know she disapproved of the implications of the theory of natural selection, but was she fully informed about what he was working on?
I think she was, yes. But I have to say, I don't really know the answer to that question. There is a book being written at the moment, and I regret to say I can't remember the name of the author. I know it's going to be published by the University of Florida Press, which is a new biography. There really hasn't been a biography of Emma Darwin, and I'm thinking this will tell us a huge amount about the relationship between the two and the family. But I don't think there's any doubt that he kept her well informed. In 1844, he had already worked out more or less what his theory would contain, and he gave her a letter in case of my death, with instructions for how this abstract of his book should be published and so on. I think she was pretty much fully informed. And in his later works, she and the children were all employed as copy editors and proofreaders and so on. It was sort of the Darwin family factory producing, you know, book after book of real brilliance. So I think they, particularly the children, were very much involved. And when he died, there was much pressure for his autobiography, which he had written, he said, just for the family. There was much pressure for it to be published, and she edited it. And what she did, actually, was take out everything that she thought was anti-religious. So she obviously was keeping an eye on what was going on.
Some biographers have suggested that Darwin was obsessed with sexuality, I guess, to a greater extent than any of the rest of us, and that is one reason that he was so focused the way he was in his work.
Yes, it's really hard to know. You can put various constructions on it. There was in the 30s a theory that he was a repressed homosexual, for instance. He certainly fathered 10 children. His father and his grandfather were. His grandfather particularly, you might have called a libertine, had 14 children by 3 different women. And of course, one part of his theory is that choice of mates, what he calls sexual selection, has a strong effect in changing external characteristics like color or the size of antlers and things like that. So I think he was interested in sex,
but not necessarily. That wasn't necessarily the formation of where he was going.
No.
With this work.
The
other theory that's being talked about a lot these days, based on a new book, is that a lot of his discussions of evolution had to do with his opposition to slavery.
Yes, that's this new book by my friends Jim Moore and Adrian Desmond. I think you can make that case, but it's not the driving case. It's an interesting and useful a point to make, and they make a really strong addition to what we know about Darwin and what he thought. But if you read my reading of his notebooks, where he is fleshing out, he's sort of casting around, trying to think what works, what doesn't work in this whole field of science. There's very little direct reference to slavery. Slavery, of course, is very much part of the general political and public milieu of the time. But my own view is that Darwin worked very much in a little bubble of science by himself, and it was only much later, when he'd already formulated his theory, that he started to reach out and read more political and economic works and philosophical works, and to see where they tied into his ideas. But I think his ideas came from the pure science first.
Keith Thompson is with us. He's Professor Emeritus of Natural History at the University of Oxford. His new book is called The Young Charles Darwin. After the break, we will talk about Darwin's time aboard the HMS Beagle. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. Keith Thompson is my guest. He is Professor Emeritus of Natural History at the University of Oxford. His new book is called The Young Charles Darwin. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We should point out for those who have forgotten that Charles Darwin, of course, did not invent the theory of evolution, Keith. In fact, his grandfather, Erasmus, same name as his brother, had written about it long before Darwin was born.
Correct, at the turn of the century. So, I suppose only 10 years before he was born, but certainly 50 years before Darwin's Origin of Species came out. He had a view that we would call sort of Lamarckist, in that he thought that the environment had a sort of major effect in directly causing changes in lineages of organisms. But what he particularly brought to the table, which was terribly important for Darwin himself, was the idea that the evolution of species in nature was the direct equivalent of animal and plant breeding on the farm and in the laboratory. So artificial selection, animal and plant breeding, is the direct equivalent of what Darwin later called natural selection. The less desirable in whatever way traits, organisms with the less desirable traits are weeded out either by the breeder or by the cruel hand of nature, and whatever is more fitted to whatever is appropriate survives. So that was a very important concept that Darwin borrowed from his grandfather. His grandfather was quite a remarkable man. His work is remarkable, but it has to be viewed more in the light of late 18th century science than 19th century science.
And his father was also a doctor and of course, sent Charles and his brother off to medical school. Was that the assumption that's what the family did and therefore that's what Darwin would do?
Yes, it was. It seems to have been the family business. Erasmus Darwin, the grandfather, was a very famous philosopher, poet, inventor, but also principally a doctor. His firstborn son was named Charles Darwin, and he was, by all accounts, utterly brilliant. And he died at a very early age from an infection from cutting his hand at an operation, a surgery in Edinburgh. All the family hopes had rested with that Charles Darwin. His younger brother Robert was then pushed into the medical mold. He did not want to be a doctor. He rather disliked being a doctor. He didn't like the sight of blood. I think he was reacting against his grandfather.
And this is Darwin's father, in fact.
This is Darwin's father. Mm-hmm. And then that was Robert Waring Darwin. And then his two sons, Erasmus and Charles, are both sent to medical school.
Ultimately, Charles Darwin quit medical school and went off to study theology at Cambridge. And you write that when he was there in 1832, and we'll trust that this is not just because you're an Oxford man, Cambridge was in fact a slacker school.
Well, it was pretty much the same at Oxford as well. For students who wanted to work really hard, it was a place where you could still get a fabulous education and achieve brilliantly. But the most people who went there were just planning to go into the church, and it was pretty much slackers. There was a lot of people. There was the horse racing set and the gambling set, Darwin sort of had to weave his way between the people who were the intellectual super achievers, which he certainly was not at that time, and the slackers. And the path that he found through that was the insect collecting.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, at the time that he ultimately boarded the HMS Beagle, he was still religious, but he never had felt really a calling toward being a parson, which was what he had decided his occupation ought to be.
I think that's right. Since medicine was out for a respectable upper middle class family, it would be the church, the law, or the army or navy. And the church was perfect for someone who was interested in being a naturalist, because there's this long-standing British tradition of the country parson who is also a serious naturalist, the greatest of them being the Reverend Gilbert White, who wrote this book, The Natural History of Selborne, which is still a classic of natural science. And that was a model that Darwin could very easily have followed from being by training to be a parson.
You do a great job in the book of really driving home the fact that it almost should never have happened that Darwin was the person aboard the Beagle. There was sort of everything stacked against him, including the fact that his dad didn't want to foot the bill for this.
That's right. Well, not just didn't want to foot the bill. He thought it was a crazy notion to go off. They thought it was going to be a two-year voyage, but it was just not the sort of thing a young gentleman would do, going off on a little Navy ship round the world with a bunch of ruffians. He had to be serious and get on with a proper profession. And he didn't really, he never really did appreciate in the early days the sort of natural history obsession of Darwin. He never shared it. And so it would just seem a crazy thing. I'm not sure that if one of my daughters had said that she wanted to die, I would have said exactly the same thing. But luckily, Darwin's uncle, Josiah Wedgwood, thought it was a great idea and persuaded Robert Darwin that it would be okay, and so he got to go on the voyage. And they were a little bit worried about the money because, as he said, it will cost a lot of money, and I understand from everybody that you're very, very good at spending money.
There was also some concern that Captain Fitzroy, who was just a few years older than Darwin, didn't like him.
Yes, it was very peculiar. You do have to remember these are very young people. Darwin was 22, Fitzroy was only 26. Darwin was from a very prominent Whig family, anti-slavery, the Wedgwoods and the Darwins, very sort of left-leaning. Fitzroy was from a very much Tory family, related to distantly to the royal family and to various lords of this, that, and the other, and his grandfather was the Duke of Grafton. And so politically, they were completely at odds. In lots of other ways, they were completely at odds, and Fitzroy was a great believer in phrenology, that you could tell someone's intelligence and character from the shape of their head. And he said that Darwin's head was all the wrong shape. And the really marvelous thing about this story is that after they came back, Darwin went home and his father looked at him and said, "Your nose is a different shape."
Huh. The primary purpose of the Beagle was what? To measure longitude around the globe?
Mm-hmm. It was to be the first ship to make a complete circle of longitude around the world, which was absolutely essential for accurately fixing positions for navigation by dead reckoning. They took, and that needed a very scientific and technical approach. Among other things, they had to have chronometers that would work precisely. These 22 chronometers they took, very, very high-powered clocks, essentially. When they got back, only three were working, but they were out of a 360-degree circle around the Earth. They were out only by 5 seconds of longitude, so it was a brilliant piece of engineering work, if you like, to do this. But that was the principal purpose of the voyage.
And how was it that Fitzroy decided to take on board a naturalist whose things would take up a lot of room? What made him decide that he wanted Darwin?
Yes, it was a tiny ship. Fitzroy was a very ambitious man. And my view of it is that he needed to have a complete scientific expedition. It would not be enough for him to just captain this tiny little Navy ship and go and make the measurements and that. He wanted everything to be absolutely perfect. The ship needed only maybe two guns, and so he had nine. They would normally have been made with iron. His were made of bronze so as not to interfere with the compasses. He took an artist. He took a musician, and he took a naturalist. And I think it's this business of wanting to do the whole thing just brilliantly, and really make a name for himself. And, of course, the voyage, quite aside from Darwin, was a tremendous scientific accomplishment of the time.
How physically hardy was Charles Darwin during the time that he was on the Beagle?
It seems pretty hardy. He made long forays on horseback across South America when the ship was engaged with, going backwards and forwards, taking soundings. He would rent a horse and an Indian guide and spend a month exploring inland and so on. And he had the usual fevers and things that you'd expect, but actually he was surprisingly healthy. And he was a really adventurous, tough young man during that time.
Which is funny because that's really not the way he was in later life at all.
And it doesn't fit at all with the conception of Darwin as this recluse who was a complete invalid from about 1830 onwards, 1838. So everything changed.
Was he compensated in any way whatsoever for the work that he was doing there?
On the voyage, you mean? No.
Yeah, yeah.
He had to pay his the Admiralty paid for his food. And everything else he had to cover himself.
And ultimately, he came home and realized he never did need to get a real job.
That's right. Well, this seems to have... He probably, at the time that he decided to give up medical school, his brother... It's not clear from the correspondence when it happened, but it did happen. His brother finally worked it out, and he essentially said to him, "Hey, look, Charles... We are going to be very, very well off. We don't ever need to work," because his mother's fortune would come to them, first the interest and then the capital. And then his father had an immense fortune. And so Erasmus told him, you know, this is it. We don't sweat it.
What kinds of accommodations were made for what Darwin needed to do aboard the ship? They would sometimes sort of wait there for him to complete his work, right?
Well, to the rest of the crew, the officers, it must at first have been quite scandalous, because they really did, if Darwin wanted to go ashore to look for something, the ship would stop. If he wanted to drag a net behind the ship, it would slow down and so on. So Fitzroy was very, very attentive to Darwin in those respects, and this must have caused some discord. And it did cause discord with the ship's surgeon, who would normally have been the naturalist, who got so fed up with Darwin being treated as a favorite that he quit.
But Darwin stayed the entire 5 years.
Darwin stayed the entire 5 years, despite terrible seasickness and despite really getting down at several points during the voyage. He got so that he never wanted to see a ship again, or especially South America again.
Yeah, and as you make clear, he had been somewhat cosseted as a child and as a young man. This was really his first baptism by fire.
Yes, it is. As I said earlier, he always had people taking care of him, and then suddenly he goes off on this voyage. It's an extraordinarily daring and exciting thing and adventurous thing to do. And you sort of have the feeling sometimes that he wore out all his adventurousness on that voyage, and he came home and turned into the recluse that we know, just as a sort of reaction. He'd used it all up.
When did the thinking that led to On the Origin of Species really start to germinate? Was it there on the ship?
The traditional view has always been that he went to the Galapagos Islands and saw these different finches and so on and started thinking about evolution, and that's not true. There are notebooks that he made on the voyage back up the North Atlantic from, you know, towards England in the last few months of the voyage, where he writes about the birds on the Galapagos and other things that he's collected and seen. And it's clear that he understands, that he's fully familiar with the notion of evolution, which any educated person would be. But it is not, there's nothing which says either, oh, I see how I have evidence that would shake the world and, you know, would change things around. Or is there anything that says, this is something I might want to look into? It's just that doesn't happen. Only that he's aware of the issue. It's only when he comes back from the voyage and is in London that he starts to think about it seriously. And that was because he gave the bird specimens to a man called Gould, who was the great expert on birds, and he said all those birds you saw on the Galapagos Islands were not simply just simple varieties island by island. They were actually different species island by island. And Darwin immediately saw that threw everything up in the air, and transmutation of species was a real fact that he then had to find a way of explaining. So he launched into it immediately after the voyage, but because of information that had been given to him.
Why do you think the story has been so oversimplified throughout the years? Nobody wants to think that Darwin had colleagues who contributed to the body of evidence that he collected.
I think partly he encouraged this view in his autobiography. He was a very private and in a way, sort of elbows-out man who didn't like to share credit with things. And in his autobiography, he really does downplay the role that other people played. But as you know, we have the benefit of a huge literature, other people's biographies, people who were classmates of his, people who took the same courses as he did, and with that, we can see that he was very, very much influenced by his formal training and his informal training, and why would he not be? He was a man of great genius, but in science, great genius still depends on that 99% perspiration of information, and he was probably the greatest sponge for information, of reading and so on, that there ever was. He was just a master of absorbing facts, and it would be very nice if he just sort of had the idea out of the, like Archimedes in the bath, but it didn't happen that way. It's clear now from what I and others have been able to find that there was a significant, important, and useful role of a lot of other people that he probably would have admitted if you'd asked him.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll take a quick call before the break from Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. If Darwin taught us anything other than his writings, it's that it seems to me that science is so much more interesting, so much more diverse than we could possibly imagine. And since your book is about young Darwin, since he didn't have this notion to draw from, I was wondering what science looked like to someone working at the time, since they didn't have that assumption. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. We will get the answer from Keith Thompson after the break. He is Professor Emeritus of Natural History at the University of Oxford. The new book is called The Young Charles Darwin. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Keith Thompson is my guest. He's Professor Emeritus of Natural History at the University of Oxford. His new book is called The Young Charles Darwin. Before the break, Keith, we have a question from Ken, who wanted to know if you could describe the scientific landscape in Darwin's day.
Yes, I think one of the reasons why Darwin was able to launch into this whole new field and essentially create it is that he was living in a time of such intense intellectual ferment and excitement. He created such excitement with his theory, but it came out of a period of tremendous excitement. People were discovering really very clearly how old the Earth must be. They didn't know a number to it, but they knew it was in the millions or billions of years. The whole orderliness of the fossil record, from relatively simple to relatively complex sort of organisms, had finally started to gel, but people were still arguing about it intensely. And because there was this notion of progression through the fossil record, the whole idea of some kind of evolution was being debated and being fought bitterly on both sides. It was a time when chemistry and physics were also really, really booming. So Darwin was very fortunate to be born into a sort of a cultural maelstrom of exciting ideas, and that's why I think he could not have been unaffected by all the teachers and other people in his university days. It just must have had a tremendous influence on him.
Darwin was not unaware of course, or even unconcerned with the implications that his ideas would have for people of faith. How did he wrestle with that question?
Well, he clearly did wrestle with it because his ideas change. If you can, I've tried in the book here to trace through his notebooks year by year as he's working on this, and he goes from a very clearly creationist point of view. That's his null hypothesis, that everything was created by the Creator more or less at one time, to the view that, well, the problem with this is that there must have been multiple creations at the same time, must have been many centers of creation. Otherwise, why would the animals of Australia be different from the animals of South America and so on? And he goes from that very quickly to what you might call a deist view, that life and the universe and whatnot is created by the Creator. But the Creator then made laws which were then allowed to run. And what happened after that was the operation of those laws rather than the day-to-day interference by or supervision by the Creator. And that is pretty much the version that he ended with in The Origin of Species. He did not ever bring himself completely to deny the role of a Creator. It's just that he thought everything that created the diversity of life on Earth that we have now was due to secondary rather than primary causes, God being the primary cause, secondary causes being the laws that arose from the matter that God created.
And even in Darwin's day, there were people who had no problem with this and didn't necessarily see it as a conflict with their faith.
That's right, because here natural selection was sort of could be presented as yet one more of the God-given laws mm-hmm. and processes.
On the other hand, his wife really had a hard time thinking, as a devout Christian, that her husband was the one who was putting all this out there.
That's right, and particularly he was putting out stuff, material that other people could make into a completely agnostic and atheistic framework quite easily, as of course has happened. So it was very tricky for her, and it was very tricky for him. He's clearly, as you read the various drafts of The Origin, he's clearly trying to steer a very careful path between what he knows and what he doesn't know, and what he is not able to pontificate about is whether there's a Creator or not. So he doesn't try to. He just assumes that there is.
Was he, can you call him then, an agnostic at the end of his life?
An agnostic, yes.
Yeah. Was he comfortable with his agnosticism?
No, I don't think so. I think he flirted with atheism, agnosticism. There were times, and he found a lot of Christianity really, really offensive. The notion that someone who did not believe was condemned to eternal damnation. In that case, it says you're talking about my father and my grandfather, and this is a damnable doctrine. On the other hand, he had been brought up very conventionally, and a lot of that conventionality stayed with him because he, as a scientist, he knew what he knew, and he knew which bits he didn't know.
Why didn't Darwin publish what would become on The Origin of Species at the moment that he conceived it?
I think two reasons. One is that he had come back from the voyage as a geologist, and he had made a name in science as a geologist. His work on evolution was done in secret because it was such a dangerous idea. And this secrecy is probably what contributed to his terrible chronic ill health, the pressure of it. But when he had the idea and he got his theory pretty well written out in 1844, it's clear to him and his few confidants that he does not have the credentials as a biologist that he needs to make this really fly. And so he set out to accomplish that by doing this immensely detailed study of barnacles, for which he won the gold medal of the Royal Society. The second thing is that he knew that his theory was, you know, the great criticism of evolution even today is, you know, it's just a theory. Well, he was worried about that, and so he wanted to assemble as many facts to support his ideas as he possibly could. So he set he set out to essentially be encyclopedic. If he couldn't, that he would persuade the doubters by a huge mass of information. And so he started work on the mass of information, and it's unclear when he would ever have come to publish. And then there had been another book on evolution published in 1844, just when he was ready, which was really savaged by all the critics. And so he saw, boy, this is a dangerous thing. I'd really better get my ducks in a row. And he might not have published for another God knows how long if Alfred Russel Wallace hadn't come up with the same idea and forced him into it.
And Wallace, did he feel double-crossed by the fact that he sort of sent his ideas to Darwin and then Darwin turned around and then published his large body of evidence right there?
No, because I think he was, if he didn't know, he was very easily persuaded that Darwin, this really was Darwin's field. He'd been working on it for 20 years. And it was not Wallace's field. Wallace's whole thrust was to explain biogeography, the distribution of animals and plants. And he became the world leader in that and was very happy to leave evolution and its contentiousness to Darwin.
Yeah, Darwin also took all the criticism in addition to all the praise.
He took all the criticism, that's right.
Are you confident that someone during that period, had it not been Charles Darwin, would have come up with a very similar set of ideas and published them?
Well, yes. Well, I mean, obviously Wallace did. But even if those two hadn't, I think... eventually, it might have taken another 20 years, but yes, all the signs were pointing in the same direction. All the information that people were gathering around the world would eventually have, I think, produced something very similar. Not identical, but something very similar to that theory. And of course, Darwin didn't have everything. He didn't understand genetics at all. No one did. So that took another 50 years.
Do you think he would be surprised to find people in places, particularly like the United States, still constantly arguing about evolution as a concept?
I think he would, yes. He was supremely confident that what he'd written was right and that it made sense, and it made sense of so many other things that it was sort of a fundamental theory of and fact of science. And I think he was certainly a modest man. He might, yes, I think he'd be surprised.
How confident was he of his own abilities in terms of science? Did he feel, was it the one thing in his life that he always felt like he was on the top of his game?
Yes, mm-hmm. I think he was always supremely confident of his abilities, of his mental abilities, and he had a great, he was a great experimenter, both with plants and animals in his garden and his greenhouses. He was a great observer. He knew from very early on that he had skills and an intelligence that nobody else had, and he never lost, I think, a tremendous self-confidence, which sort of helped him accomplish what he did.
Are his collections still intact?
Some are. A lot are at the University of Cambridge, some at the British Museum, the Natural History Museum, it's now called, in London. But quite a lot of his collections are intact, yes.
And I understand that Darwin is not the controversial figure in the UK that he is in this country.
No, that's right. I think this is the one, of all the countries in the world, the United States has made it, it has become or remained more controversial than anywhere else. Though, funnily enough, things are changing a little bit in England. The controversy is being imported a little bit, both from two quarters, from fundamental religious quarters, both Christian and Muslim. There's a large Muslim population in Europe generally. So what was very secure, say, 20 years ago is now more under attack than it was. But it's still entirely, I mean, it's just a night and day from this country.
How can you describe some of the sort of celebrations that are taking place there? And I know you happen to be in San Francisco right now, but this anniversary is a big deal.
This is a huge deal by the fact that it's the 200th anniversary of his birth and the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. And everywhere in the world, everybody is they're getting together for meetings, celebrations, putting on exhibitions, writing books, trying to sell books, and it's just I actually am quite surprised myself on the outpouring of interest in Darwin. It's much greater than I thought it would be, And the amount of material that's available online through the Darwin Project at the University of Cambridge is simply stunning. You can find out so much about Darwin just by going online. And I hope that he will be really pleased by the fact that people are paying so much attention to him.
It's got to be challenging to write about someone who has been well-documented and who has written his own autobiography, but, you know, as you mentioned, in some cases sort of gilded the lily and in other cases left out certain facts. How challenging is it when you have a journal or an autobiography that says one thing and a whole lot of evidence on the other side that maybe portrays a different kind of person?
Well, it is challenging. It's the sort of challenge that I rather like. I like reading detective stories, for instance. And so the reason I wrote this book is that I was very familiar with all the standard views of Charles Darwin, and they just didn't ring true. So then there's the tremendous pleasure of sifting through all the information and trying to sort through the conflicting information. And there's a huge Darwin industry of people, very distinguished scholars, who have spent a lot of time just trying to decipher his handwriting in his notebooks. People like myself depend very much upon those scholars, but he's still a bit of an enigma, and as an enigma, he's a tremendous challenge. And so I don't think people ever stop writing about him. We'll continue to find out little bits more about him. He is important, but also he's this important challenge.
What do you think about the speculation that he might have had a touch of Asperger's syndrome?
I saw that just the other day. There's practically no syndrome known to man or woman that he hasn't been thought of as having, frankly. And my own view is that his health situation is a lot simpler and in one sense and more complicated than anybody thinks. I think virtually, say, 90% of his health problems were due to chronic anxiety. And that anxiety exacerbated the sort of normal frailties that all humans all have, plus a sort of negative food feedback loop in this terrible hypochondria he had. So in a way, I think he wasn't as sick organically as he was in terms of symptoms. And there are two reasons that support me in that and others in this view. One is, when he was not working on something controversial, he would sort of recoup by writing a book about something to do with plants, like the fertilization of orchids or climbing plants. He had a lovely book on climbing plants, or his book on earthworms. And these books were a tremendous pleasure for him to work on. He experimented in the garden and the greenhouse. And when he was doing those works, his health was really quite good. Huh. And then he'd get into an intense cerebration of something complicated, and his health would collapse.
Keith Thompson is Professor Emeritus of Natural History at the University of Oxford. His new book is called The Young Charles Darwin. Keith, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.